Okay, so for those of you who were here before, I made two sets of short sheets. One is the shorter one that we gave out now. The reason, normally I don't do that, but I felt with the death penalty I couldn't give it short shrift, and I had to at least have the sources for people either to look at in advance or afterwards. So there are still a few afterwards if you want the longer source sheets in the back. But a little bit of background. This year, we've devoted both our Shabbatonim and our Yarchikala and a page in our Toronto Torah to celebrating 70, to discussing issues in the state of Israel, celebrating the fact that this is the 70th year that we've had a modern state of Israel. Now, one of the topics that has really been quite heated in Israel in the last few months has been the question of the death penalty. Now, historically, Israel, it has a death penalty on the books, but it's only ever been used. It's been twice has someone been sentenced to death, but it's only actually been used once, and that was for Eichmann in 1962 for crimes against humanity. But in general, Israel has been very reticent about using the death penalty, even as it has remained as a possibility on the books. But recently, the last few years, there's been a move to not just have it as a possibility, but as a requirement for terrorist activity. Right? To require that the punishment be for terrorist activity to be the death penalty. And for years that had been brought up and always been rejected, but at the moment, it was brought up again. Now, if you know the Israeli sort of legislative system, for a law to be passed, it has to go through three readings in the Knesset. So the moment where we stand is as of January, this law, which requires the death penalty to be given to people convicted of terrorist activity, has passed the first reading, and now we'll see what happens in the second and third readings of the law. It is not yet law. There's still a lot of hurdles that has to pass. But for that reason, since this is being debated in the Knesset, it is a heated question in Israel. So I thought it would be time to really examine this question. Because, at first glance, if you ask someone, right, does the Torah believe in the death penalty? The answer would be yes, right? It definitely believes in it, right? As the Rambam nicely summarizes for you, there are 36 crimes for which the Torah mandates the death penalty: 18 by stoning, 10 by burning, whatever exactly. We won't get into the details of what Sreifa means in Halacha. 2 by decapitation, and 6 by strangulation. Where the Torah has 36 crimes which carry with it the death penalty, and yet, if you look at the sort of rabbinic history in the last 70 years, many, if not most, rabbinic leaders strongly opposed having a death penalty in Israel. Rav Herzog, the first Ashkenazi chief rabbi of the state, opposed it. And just recently, after the first reading of this law in Knesset, Rav Yitzchak Yosef came out strongly opposed to the law mandating death penalty for terrorists. And the question is why, right? Why has there been sort of a very strong rabbinic opposition to this? And it's not just, as we'll see, it's not just in Israel, but when Moshe Feinstein was asked the question by, he was asked the Jewish position with regard to the death penalty as politicians in America were formulating laws. So, as he writes it in Purim 57:41, he was asked, he said to the governor of this state, I don't know exactly who he's talking to, but he opposes the death penalty. He says, Halacha doesn't like the death penalty. We don't want the death penalty. Raron Soloveitchik was asked and wrote a letter to David Lukens where he wrote, I don't want there to be a death penalty. If you want to say that you support the death penalty, you can say that, but don't say the name of Judaism, because to quote him, he says, in my humble opinion, from a halachic point of view, every Jew should be opposed to capital punishment, right? But that was his statement. And the question is, how do you get from a Torah which has 36 capital crimes to this rabbinic sentiment that in Israel and America, Jews should be opposed to the death penalty either at all or at least to it being mandated, right? How do we sort of square that circle? And that's what I want to try to do, because you know we're not gonna settle this debate today. I know your conclusion. You're opposed to it. Maish told me before, and he has a strong rabbinic tradition behind him. But the question is really why, right? Where does it come from? Because this opposition to the death penalty is not new. Right? It's from the Mishnah. Right? You look at number one. The Mishnah tells you that Sanhedrin ha'oreget echad bishavua nikrei chovlanit, a Sanhedrin that executes a transgressor once in 7 years, is characterized as a destructive tribunal. Rilazar ben Azariah omer echad lishivim shana. And Rilazar ben Azariah says, no, even if they kill once in 70 years, they are a destructive, they are a murderous court. And Rabbi Tarfon and Rabbi Akiva, they go even farther. And they said, omrim ilu hayinu b'Sanhedrin, if we were in the Sanhedrin, lo neherag adam me'olam, no one would have ever been killed. And I didn't give it to you in the Gemara, but the Gemara says, how could you say that? Right? What would you have done to make sure that no one would ever be killed? Right? There is a procedure. If two witnesses come in and say that Reuven worshipped Avodah Zarah, he worshipped idolatry, and we warned him, and he said, even though I'm going to be punished, I'm going to commit the crime, you can construct a case where someone would be put to death. How can you say you'd never kill someone? So the Gemara goes through a series of mental gymnastics and said, well, if it was murder, so you would say to the person, do you know if the murder victim was viable or not? Meaning, was he healthy? Or was he trefa? And if he was sick such that he would die within 12 months, you're not liable for the death penalty. And if you can't answer that question, so then we won't put the person to death. So the Gemara says, okay, what if he was his physician? Right? And they don't say that. But what if he knew he was healthy? So what would you do then? So the Gemara says they would ask them, how do you know that when he stabbed him, he hadn't been previously stabbed just a few minutes ago, and that he put the sword exactly in the same hole where the sword had been put previously? How do you know that he was the murderer? Maybe it was someone else. And the Gemara says, okay, what if it was adultery? And the Gemara says, well, we'd pin him down. We'd say, how close were you such that you actually saw the act of adultery? Do you actually know they were together? Right? The Gemara goes through and tries to figure out, what could we do to trip up the witnesses? So it's not just that the Gemara is saying we would avoid dealing with the questions, but we would go out of our way to trip up the witnesses, make it impossible to convict. Now, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel pushes back and says, no, afein mar ben shofchei dam Yisrael, you can't be that extreme in pushing against the death penalty, because if you do that, then you're removing the deterrent from murderers, and you may be having mercy on the criminals, but you are being cruel to their future victims. But even before Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, what you get in the Gemara, in the Mishnah already, is this strong opposition to actually implementing the death penalty. And that tension, that the death penalty clearly exists in Torah, but the Mishnah, right, everyone's just trying to one-up everyone else. How opposed to the death penalty are you? Right? Are you opposed every 7 years, every 70 years? Do you never want it to happen? And then the Gemara tries to figure out, what do you mean every 70 years? Is it that once in 70 years is okay, more than that is bad? Or even once in 70 years, it would be considered a murderous Beit Din. The Gemara doesn't know. If it was once in 70 years, it would be called destructive, Odim Orach Arahi, or is once in 70 years the norm? Take it, the Gemara doesn't know. But everyone's trying to push and ensure that the death penalty won't happen too much or ever. Right. How does that, where do they get this notion that the law is on the books, and yet the last thing on earth we want to do is implement it? Right? And that tension, that question, is really where you have to look if you want to understand not just the theoretical halacha, but what we should do policy-wise. Do we want there to be a death penalty? Do we want to make it easier to give the death penalty or required to give the death penalty, or, you know, do we want to get rid of it totally? Do we want to leave it on the books but leave it as an unstated agreement that will never really implement it, with the exception of Eichmann, who, you know, at this point, right, Israel is exactly at that happy medium, so to speak, of the Gemara, right? 70 years in, and we've had one execution, right? We've now hit that moment, right? If we don't put anyone to death until next year, then we're over 70 years with one execution, and that's the, right, that's apparently the happy medium, right? Which you sort of get, right? Eichmann is an exceptional case in a terrible way. So how do we explain it? So, I didn't give this to you in the shorter source sheets because it's very long. If you want to look at it afterwards, it's in the longer one. But many people point to the Ran in his 11th drasha to explain to sharpen the question, sharpen the tension. The Ran says as follows. The Ran asks a more basic question. He said, "What is the point of having law? And what is the point of law?" So before I give you the Ron's answer, right? If I throw it out to you, what is the point of law? Why do we have law at all? Right? So one possibility is we just need to be civilized. We need social order. Without law, as we said, right, as the Mishnah said, right, you should support the government, because without government, ish et reo chayim bla'o, right? People will swallow each other alive. You just need a level of order in society. That's one function of law. What else does law do?
It implements divine justice.
No? Yeah, it implements divine justice. I don't know if you've read the Ran or you just are deeply spiritual, but the Ran says the other thing that Jewish, especially Jewish law, does is it expresses divine justice in the world. Now the Ran, he loves this idea, so he goes farther and he says, well, Jewish law accounts for both of those two roles. The Sanhedrin is tasked with implementing God's justice in this world. And he gets a bit mystical on you, and he says that brings down the Shefa Eloki, right? It brings down the divine effluence, I don't know, something like that, right? The divine spirit into the world, whatever. And that's the role of the Sanhedrin. The Melech, the king, is in charge of maintaining order. And therefore the Ran says that, he says, if you look at the Torah, this is sort of an amazing claim. He says, if you look at the Torah, if you tried to build a society around Torah law, it would not work. It just wouldn't work. There's not enough there for society to function. The Torah assumes a king, and the Mishpat HaMelech, the law of the king, is not limited to what is found in Torah. He is tasked with creating whatever laws and ensuring that there is order, whatever that takes. But if you just had laws on the books, that would not be enough. Society would just cease to function. And that's why we have a melech, right? He says, the whole world needs law and order. The melech functions the way it does for any other government. The Sanhedrin, you know why, when you look at the Sanhedrin's laws, that's not enough to maintain order in society? Because that's not the point. The point is to manifest God's justice. But they're not tasked with maintaining society. And therefore, now this Ran became very important for early religious Zionist poskim because it was the way they framed the justification for recognizing the authority of the state of Israel. The argument went basically like this. The Ran says that there's two models recognized by Jewish law, one which follows halakha and one which does whatever necessary to create a society. The Melech is in charge of creating order. And then Rav Kook, in a celebrated tshuva, said, well, what happens if you don't have a king? So then he gets very philosophical and he says, well, the authority of a king, you think that a king is sort of this divinely ordained leader. It's sort of true, but really his authority stems from the people. And therefore, if the people choose not to have a king, they can give over their power, which normally went to a king, to any other government. And therefore, you could have a malchut without a melech, right? A kingdom without a king, or in other words, you could have a democracy. You could have whatever government you want. And that government would take on the authority of Mishpat Melech, of the king, and therefore would be recognized halachically under this model called the king. Right? That's sort of the early religious Zionist argument of why we can recognize law in Israel. But then the Ran goes farther. And the Ran says, well, you know what? From the vantage point of the Sanhedrin, of justice in this world, we're very hesitant to actually implement the death penalty. Because by the Sanhedrin killing somebody, what are you saying? You are, right? You are the Dayan, right? You are the judge who can put someone to death. That takes a lot for someone to be comfortable saying, I am filling God's shoes to put somebody to death, to take away life. So the Sanhedrin, very much we opposed using the death penalty. But we didn't always oppose the death penalty at all. We opposed it for the Sanhedrin. But let's say it would be necessary, so then the Melech could do it. Right? In the realm of Mishpat HaMelech, and we'll come back to this idea in a little bit, but within the realm of Mishpat HaMelech, we could create a death penalty in the social order side of things. And that's why the Ran, and as we'll see, says even though it's true that we oppose the death penalty for Sanhedrin, we didn't necessarily do the same in non-courtroom settings. But that still sort of begs the question, okay, but why even from Sanhedrin? If the law is on the books, why don't we want to give the death penalty? Right, what is it? I mean, yes, it's hard. But we still have to ask, okay, but what exactly is it, right? We say, okay, you know, it's you don't want to be God, but what is it about the death penalty that makes us so uncomfortable having Sanhedrin actually implement it? So, if you look at number one again, right, what would you say, right? Why is it that we're so hesitant to have the Sanhedrin implement the death penalty? Right, what clues do you have in number one? There aren't so many clues. There isn't so much. So one possibility, you could have just said, you know, and this is sort of what everybody talks about now, right, is that at a very simple level, we're always unsure whether the evidence is sufficient. Right? There's a problem, right? The death penalty is irreversible. And if you're wrong, there's nothing we can do. So one way of saying the reason we're opposed to the death penalty in practice is that we're scared because we might be wrong. But Professor Gerald Blitzstein notes that that is a very hard way of reading the Mishnah. Now, there are significant people who suggest that this is the case. The Rambam, for example. The Rambam does suggest that this is the case. But he notes that it's a bit hard for the following reason. Reb Shimon ben Gamliel in the Mishnah said what? I can't sign on to your absolute opposition to the death penalty because by getting rid of the death penalty, you will be Marbin Shofchei Damim B'Yisrael. You will increase murderers. But what does that sound like? It sounds like what's the plane they're arguing on, the axis they're arguing on. People who are known to be murderers, should we put them to death? Right? It sounds like there's at least cases where Rav Shimon Gamliel is saying there's someone who is a murderer, and the way he understands Rabbi Kiva and Rabbi Tarbon is even though you know they're murderers, you would rather not kill them. Which means it's not a question of, now, of course, you could sort of fudge it, right, and say no. By getting rid of the death penalty, someone is a murderer. You never know who it is for sure. So one second, we just finished this thought. He said, you never know for sure who the murderer is, right? You know that if you have 10 people who came in as murderers, there's a chance that one of them is actually a murderer. If we just said there'll never be a death penalty, then all of them are going to get off, and no one's going to be scared in the future. Right? So you could sort of fudge it and say, it's not that he's saying even someone who's known as a murderer, you wouldn't put to death, it's just Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Tarfon saying, I never know who it is. Right? I theoretically agree, but he notes that it seems like the argument is more fundamental. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel is saying, look, I can't agree with getting rid of the death penalty because there are murderers you're getting off scot-free, and Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Tarfon say, I really don't care. Right? I don't care. We don't want to implement the death penalty. Yeah.
So Rabbi Shimon Gamliel is saying that by not murdering people that are known to be murderers, if you're going to increase murder generally amongst Israel, and the simple response to that could be, why don't you just jail that person for life?
And hold that thought, because we're going to come back to it. We're going to hold that thought, and we're going to come back to it. Because we are, like, number seven. We're going to come back to it in seven. So when this question first came up in the 40s, at the time, Rabbi Warhaftig, was he a rabbi? Politician. From the I think he was a rabbi also. I think he was ordained, right? All his kids are as well. He's like, my wife learned with his son in the Yoetzit program, but all his sons are very prominent. But Zerach Warhaftig was a very prominent religious political leader in the founding years of the state, and he opposed the death penalty. And he said, why? He said, it's very simple. The reason we don't like the death penalty is because, despite what the Pasuk says, right? The Pasuk tells you in Noach, right, that someone who kills deserves to be killed. But he said, it's not just that the Gemara tells us that we don't like the death penalty and we try not to implement it. All the laws about implementing the death penalty make it clear we really don't want to do this, right? We make it impossible. We require two witnesses to be there. We require that the witnesses not be relatives. We require that the witnesses warn the murderer within Tokadei Dibur, within 3 seconds of the crime. And we require the murderer to verbally assent to being punished, right? Al menat kenan yosa, I am committing the crime for this. And then, even if you've gone through all this, once the witnesses get into court, we drive them crazy, right? We drive them absolutely up the wall, right? What time was it? Where was the sun in the sky? What was he wearing, right? Certain questions can undermine the testimony. Certain can undermine the testimony if they don't answer, but can if they get it wrong. But we drive them crazy, and we try to terrify them. We try to mess them up. But in the middle of that, in number two, we say the following. How do we terrify them? So in the middle of the speech, the judge says to the witnesses, "Lefichach nivra adam yechidi." It was for this reason that man was created alone. Lilamet, meaning Adam. One person at first. Lilamedcha, to teach you, shekol ha-abed nefesh achat. Mi Yisrael, though in the better Gersot it doesn't have Mi Yisrael, it just says Nefesh Achat. Anyone who causes a life to be lost, Ma'ale alav akatu ki li be olam malei. It's as if he destroyed an entire world. The call Mekayem Nefesh Achat Mi Yisrael, or Nefesh Achat, anyone who sustains a life, Ma'ale alav akatu ki lu kiyem olam malei. It's as if he sustained an entire world. Then we go on. Just look at the last line. And then he says, "V'shema tomru malanu lachov b'damo shel zeh." And after we terrify them, they might say, "What? Why do we need to be responsible for this guy's blood?" So then we say, "No, because destroying the wicked, the destruction of the wicked, there is rejoicing." Meaning after everything, right, they're convinced. So they're like, okay, but why am I here? If you don't want me to testify, just tell me. And we say, no. If we can check off every single box, then sure, there are times when we would implement the death penalty because we want to get rid of Rishayim. But, right, Warhaftig pointed out, he said, why in the middle of the speech do we tell the person, by the way, human life is really valuable? And destroying a life is like destroying a world. So one possibility is that we're telling him that because if he's lying, we want him to know how bad it would be to kill someone if he's lying. But it seems to be even more than that. It's not just if he's innocent, we don't want him to be killed. It's that we want him to understand the gravity of killing someone, even if they're guilty. I mean, even if someone is guilty and deserves it, he's still in Olam Mala. And therefore, Reuar Haftig said, you know, the reason the Torah opposes actually implementing the death penalty is because as much as on the books we say it exists, actually implementing it is hard because we don't like killing people because people are valuable. Now, Professor Blitzstein had a brilliant way of proving that this is the theology of the Torah. Everything he does is brilliant. He's just one of those people. But he wrote this when he was younger than I am, so I'm like, okay. Which he's not anymore, if you're wondering. He's like 80-something. But when he was 27, he wrote this article, if I did my math correctly. He said, I'll prove it to you. He said as follows. What does the word ritzicha mean? Translate ritzicha into English.
Murder.
In English, we say murder. Why do we say murder and not kill? What?
We have another word,
hereg. And therefore, what is the assumption when we say ritzicha is murder and not killing? What's the assumption?
It's intentional.
That, right? Or, even more broadly, that there's a difference between good killing and bad killing. Right? That's what we're assuming. There's ritzicha, which is bad, and hereg, which might be good, might be bad. Right? Killing is just descriptive. Retzach is more morally charged. But that's what we're saying. So, lo tirtzach, we translate as you shall not murder. And that's the way the Rashbam takes it. In 4, lo tirtzach, kol ritzicha, hariga bechinam hi bechol makom. The word retzach is always unjustified murder. Right? In English, just murder, as opposed to killing. But Professor Blitzstein points out that's not at all simple in the Chumash. Because you look at number 5, in the middle of discussing the accidental murderer, or the accidental killer, the pasuk says as follows, Kol make nefesh, lefi edim, yirtzach et harotzeach. Right? If anyone kills a person, then the murderer will be killed by witnesses. Now look at the translation, right? This is important, right? This is how the English tries to render it. If anyone kills a person, right? This is from the JPS. If anyone kills a person, the manslayer may be executed only on the evidence of witnesses. Right? They use 3 different words to translate killing in that pasuk. And they translate the phrase yirtzach et harotzeach as the manslayer may be executed. But in Hebrew, it's yirtzach et harotzeach, which means that what? The murderer will be murdered by Beit Din, al pi edim, with witnesses, meaning justified. So Professor Blitzstein says, you know what the Torah thinks? The Torah thinks that the line between justified murder and unjustified murder is not that clear cut. You can't get away from, you can't just say, well, for me, I'm the court. It's justified. This isn't ritzicha, it's hereg. Right? This is killing and not murder. The Torah doesn't want you to think that way. It wants you to realize that the line, there's no bright line between justified and unjustified killing. It's all ritzicha. You have to realize that what you're doing is yirtzach et harotzeach. You're being a murderer. Right? There is no, don't try to clean it in your head, whitewash it in your head and say, I'm doing hereg, he did ritzicha. It's trying to blur the lines. It's trying to underscore how bad killing somebody is, even when it's justified. And it's that sentiment that even though it's on the books, it's really bad. It's always bad to kill somebody. That creates the reticence on behalf of everyone from the Mishnah to, you know, Rav Herzog and Yitzchak Yosef from actually having a death penalty. But on the other hand, that's not the whole story. Because on the other hand, look at 6. Sometimes the Torah tells you, Lo tachosein cha'alav, uvi'arta dam nakim Yisrael v'tovlach. Sometimes the Torah tells us, show him no pity. You will purge Israel of the blood of the innocent and it will go well with you. Right? Sometimes the Torah says, but you know what? We really don't like evil people. And for all that we say, we don't want to implement the death penalty. The Gemara says in 7 that sometimes, Tanya, Rilazim and Yaakov, Omer, Shamati, Shebetin, Makin, Va'unjin, Shalom, and Torah. Sometimes the Sanhedrin has the right to punish, not based on the law, extrajudicially. Not to violate the Torah, but to protect it. There was once a case of someone who rode a horse on Shabbos in the times of the Greeks, which is a rabbinic violation of Shabbat, which carries with it what punishment? At best, Malchus Mardus, right? Rabbinic lashes, but biblically, nothing. And they brought him to court and they killed him. They stoned him as if it was a biblical violation of Shabbat.
The state shemesh?
What? Oi, oi. Lo ibn sharui lekach, not because he deserved it, ela sheshat tzricha lekach, because it was necessary. Shuv ma'aseh ba'adam echad shetiach et ishto tachat ha'teinah. There was a case of a husband who slept with his wife under a fig tree, which is not a death penalty. Right, it's just a lack of tzniut, it's a lack of propriety. And they gave him malchus. So on the other hand, right, coming back now to the other side of the Ron. On the one hand, yes, the court doesn't want to implement the death penalty. But on the other hand, sometimes, to keep social order, we need to invoke punishments that aren't called for. Right, it's the opposite extreme. Right, sometimes we won't kill somebody who deserves it. And sometimes we'll kill somebody who doesn't really deserve it to maintain social order. Now, the Ran says that that is the realm of the king and not Beit Din. The Abarbanel, the beginning of Shoftim, says no. The fact that it's the court that's doing it shows you, right, the Ran has a very fancy argument, that it's the court functioning on behalf of the king. Right, the Abarbanel says no. What you see from this is that the court has two roles, maintaining order and implementing God's theoretical justice. But either way, what becomes clear is that to maintain order, sometimes we go to the opposite extreme and say, well, kill people who don't deserve it. But, as was mentioned, once we're in the realm not of justice, but in the realm of social order, what option do we always have? Coming up with a different way of maintaining order. Now, in the time of the Gemara, the way they did it was by, in the, at least in the case of murder, as the Gemara says in 8, the Mishnah says actually in 8, that Mishal Akavishana Beitin Machnisinoto Likipa Machilanto Sarin Achi Kreso Mitvakat. If someone was flogged multiple times, meaning he keeps sinning, or the next case, Haring Nevesh Lo Beidim, if someone who we know he murdered, but there aren't enough witnesses to convict him, Machnisinoto Likipa Machilanoto Lechem Sarumayim Lachatz. So in both cases, what we do is we have a punishment called Kipa. We lock them up in a room. We don't feed them, and then when we do feed them, we feed them dry barley, and then we give them water, and then the barley expands in their stomach and crushes their internal organs, and they die. Right? It's a terrible, terrible punishment. Now, what is that? What is that punishment? So that punishment is, it's not the death penalty, it's worse than the death penalty, but what is it? It's a way of us not actually killing him actively, but making sure that he's out of the picture through death. And why, again, why do we do that? Because on the second side of the equation, sometimes we say, look, it may be that we don't want to put him to death or we can't put him to death, but if we don't do anything, to quote Rav Shimon Gamliel, Mar bin Shofchei Damim bi Yisrael. Right? If you're too lenient, then there's no deterrent. And the Rambam in 9 tells you, now the Rambam puts a qualification. He says, you know what? Here, one way of compromising here is to say, note that we only say this extrajudicial punishment of kippah when? By murder. Only by murder. Why? So we don't say it anywhere else. Normally, either we put him to death or we don't. Even though there may be sins that are worse than murder, like idolatry, let's say. There's nothing which is quite as destructive to the fabric of society as murder. Even Avodah Zarah, and for sure, the illicit sexual relationships or Shabbos violation, Because those are ritual law between you and God. But murder is between people. And anyone who murders is the ultimate sinner. And all the good deeds he did in his life are worth nothing compared to this. They won't save him from justice. And I'll prove it. Achav was an idolater. He was one of the Israelite kings. But when God decided to punish him, it wasn't because of the idol worship, it was because he killed Navot. And he didn't even kill Navot himself. His wife had it arranged that Navot got killed, without getting to the story. But the Rambam tells you that maybe one of the ways of squaring this is saying, well, we would only ever implement this actual judicial killing for murder, because it's unique. It's sort of in a category in itself. But the truth is, you look at the Mishnah, it's very hard to say that, because there's two people we give kippah to. There's two people we give kippah to: murderers and someone who just sins a lot. So it's a bit hard. It's a bit hard to say that it's absolutely sui generis, absolutely unique. But okay, that's the Rambam's take on it. But what you see here is this tension. Right? On the one hand, we're opposed to the death penalty because we're never sure we'll get it right, because human beings' life are so sacrosanct that we don't want to kill ever, no matter what. On the other hand, a recognition that if we don't have any sort of punishment, society will go crazy. And sometimes that even requires killing people. And if you look at the next few sources, you'll see that certain sources even, I don't know if glorify, but play up the inherent value in punishing those who deserve it. Right, pushing back, not just in the practical, right? We push back, first we push back practically, but there are also sources that push back fundamentally and say, don't get so worked up and say it's always wrong to kill, to murder, to put to death. Sometimes it's not so bad, or it's not so bad. It's the right thing to do, right? So for example, Sifrei number 10 says, Lo tachos incha alav, v'yarta damanaki. Let your eye not pity him and remove the innocent blood. Shema tomar hoel v'nei rag zeh. What might you say? Well, look, this argument might sound familiar. The person who's killed is already dead. Why should we kill another person, right? What is killing two people? Help. Talmud lomar to lo tachos incha alav. The Torah tells you don't have pity. I mean, sometimes the Sifrei says, no. People who kill deserve to die. And in 11, you find out that another reason, why do we put people to death? Not just because they deserve it, but sometimes as we've sort of hinted, we've come back to, but now to get a pasuk for it, as a deterrent. Vanisharim yishmu v'yiro, those that survive, those that remain, will be here and afraid. And people will no longer do the evil. And the Sefer HaChinuch in 12 says, V'ulam harishayim ha'gumurim k'gon ha'minim ha'malshinim enam miyashvei ha'olam, those totally evil people, heretics and talebearers, they don't settle the world. That we rejoice at the loss, the destruction of evildoers. Because they won't settle the world. They'll destroy it with all their strength. That the loss, the destruction of Rishayim, it's like getting rid of thorns from the world. By getting rid of these, the world will be settled more. Just like fruit will grow better if there is if we get rid of the thorns. So you have these two poles. On the one hand, you have this strong opposition to the death penalty, because we might not be sure that the person's guilty, because killing is always wrong, it's always hard to take a human life, because you're stepping in the place of God. On the other hand, we have a pushback for practical reasons, namely that sometimes if you don't take care of things, it'll just be worse for society. Right? By having mercy on the murderer, you let people get out and kill others. And on a fundamental level, at some level, people who deserve to die, deserve to die. Right? There is at some level a value to that. Right? Don't have mercy on him because he deserves it. And there's a deterrent effect. Right? It's not just the individual murderer. Sometimes there's a deterrent effect. And it was these two sides that, you know, the rabbis of the Talmud struggled with and people continue to struggle with. Is how do you square those? Now, to fully flesh it out, just to throw out a few more sources here, because there are a few more sources that fill out the conversation. One question we've sort of been dancing around is, okay, I get why you'd want to have the death penalty, I get why you wouldn't. But if you really don't want the death penalty most of the time, and even we want the death penalty, it's certain sins that we're really, you know, it's only really murder maybe that we're really into it, to the extent that we're into it. Right? Why is it on the books for 36 different crimes? Right? Meaning, by simple mathematics, right, if they only killed once every 70 years, and there are 36 different crimes you could get it for, right, how often did anyone get put to death for any given crime? You get the feeling that maybe it happened once in a while for murder, maybe idolatry, but, you know, I don't know. There were probably some of the arayot that no one ever got put to death for. I don't know. I'm just throwing out an example. But, right, with 36 possibilities there, if it was once every 70 years, how often? There are some crimes that they probably never had the death penalty implemented at all. So why is it even there? Right? What is the point of the death penalty on the books? Is there value to having death penalty on the books if you're not going to implement it? Why don't you just say, in the language of the Ron, that we have a king who maintain order? Why have it on the books at all? If it's necessary, let the king kill. Why is it there? So why is it there? Why is the death penalty there? Why is it true that in Canada, for 12 years, I think it was, between when Canada stopped using the death penalty to when it officially abolished it, there were several crimes that still technically you could get the death penalty for? It was never used, but you could. It was treason and crimes against humanity and I forget what else, but there were like three or four crimes that in Canada, there was a 12-year period where theoretically it was on the books, but no, but there had already been a moratorium. No one was ever going to use it. Why do you do that? Why is it on the books even? Yeah. One is a deterrent, but if you've already said, the government had already said, we will never implement it. We just haven't gotten rid of it. Right? What is the value of that? What? So one possibility is maybe you'll bring it back. So it's still a deterrent. Or... Yeah. As a statement of our values. Right? That theoretically this is so bad it carries with the death penalty. And you see that. And I'll give you just two sources. One is the Gemara that appears several times in that same Amud, which is this notion of drosh v'kabal schar. Right? The Gemara says, why is it if there will never be a ben sorer moreh, right, the rebellious son, or an idolatrous city, why is it even in the Torah? The Gemara says, drosh v'kabal schar, so that you'll learn it and you'll get a reward, right? Which I tend to not think of in Brisker terms. Not like you'll learn Torah and you get reward for learning Torah, but you'll get the values of it, you'll understand the values and get reward for internalizing the Torah values. But an even clearer formulation, this is by the Rambam. The Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says, right, treat a light mitzvah like a strict mitzvah, right? Because you never know you never know whether mitzvot are equal. But the Rambam in 14 says it's not totally true. It's only true for positive mitzvot. It's not true for negative. It's not true for prohibitions. For prohibitions, you do know what's greater and what's not. How do you know? The death penalty, right? Meaning he said it's only positive mitzvot you don't know the reward for, so you don't know how great they are. But prohibitions, you know there is a hierarchy. It's called how bad is the punishment. But the Rambam is sort of swallowing there that what is the point for the Rambam of having laws on the books? To teach you how bad they are. Right? That's what the Rambam is telling you, that you can think there's a value to having on the book even if there's an implicit understanding we'll never use it because it teaches people about our values. Also, one of the reasons I think that the Sanhedrin didn't always feel compelled to implement it but wanted it on the books is because it's not just theoretically we should know how bad punishment is, but also, how bad the crime is, but what else? It's to remind us That when God carries out his justice, you were warned, and it was really bad. Right, and that's what the Gemara really says in 15. That Hai Bar Nachash Uvamar Rabbi Yosef Echentani Bechizkia Miyom Shechar Beit HaMikdash Avo Bisha Batlas Sanhedrin Arba Mitot Lo Batlu. That even though the Sanhedrin hasn't existed since the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash and even a little bit before, the four death penalties exist. The Gemara says Lo Batlu. They weren't nullified. Right? Fabitlu. They were nullified. Eladin Arba Mitot Lo Batlu. The law isn't. And the Gemara goes on to explain. If someone deserves stoning, God will ordain that he falls off a roof. Right? If he deserves to be decapitated, it'll happen. But what's the Gemara telling you? That you don't always have to worry about justice. It's on the books to tell you that when God does it, don't be surprised. But it also tells you don't have to be so worried about actually doing it, because they're not getting off scot-free, because God will do it. So taking that all together, right, and there are many more sources, and I gave you, if you want, the long version. Again, it's in the back. You can read it afterwards, because I felt with the death penalty, I should at least, for people who are interested, give you the sources to go home with, because I can't, there's not a topic I can just say, okay, you know, figure it out. And, you know, it's an important topic. It's a very weighty topic. But what you see is that this sort of struggle is in classic sources. On the one hand, we think there's a value to having the death penalty on the books because it teaches people something. It teaches people that there will be a justice. There will be an accounting by God. It teaches people how bad certain sins are. There's an educational aspect to having it on the books. But in terms of implementation, we're constantly pulled between, on the one hand, trying to avoid giving the death penalty because we don't want to be God, and we don't want to play with human life, and we don't want to be wrong. But on the other hand, a recognition that sometimes people deserve it. Very rarely, but sometimes you really have to implement it, maybe. And that even if you're not going to, you need to find ways of maintaining order. That trying to figure out where we find our own place in between those two poles is the struggle of halacha itself, and was the struggle that poskim were trying to figure out when they were trying to add a Torah moral voice to the debates around the death penalty. And it was for this reason that so many rabbinic voices opposed it entirely. Right? Because they said, you know what, without the Sanhedrin, without that theoretical value, right, that we're, because, you know, without someone to represent God's justice, there's no value to it. Then you'll say, okay, well, what about murderers? Put them in jail. Right? If it's about social order, put them in jail. Or for Yitzhak Yosef, he said he's worried that what will happen is it'll be overused. Right? Once it's on the books, it'll be used for people who don't really deserve it. Right? Jew and non-Jew alike.
What's the problem with having it just for terrorists?
What?
What's the problem with having it just for terrorists?
Because they're Jew.
It's going to be overused.
Well, it will be, right? Because we go, how do you define terrorism? Right? How do you define terrorism, right? There and you know, as he said, there are, you know, constantly you'll see, right? If one person is killed, you find it's terrorism. What if, right? And you know, you can't, once it's on the books, you can't only use it, you know, for Palestinian terrorists. If you have a Jew who commits the same act, right? It's an act of terrorism, right? And he's worried it's going to be misused or overused. Now, the people who want there to be a death penalty say, look, the fact is it hasn't been a deterrent, right? It hasn't been a deterrent. Life in prison isn't a deterrent because A, the prisons are good. B, right? Often the murderers get out in exchanges, right? And they say, well, we want to make a statement. Terrorism is wrong. Murder is wrong. You can't glorify murder. We're not saying every murderer. We're saying terrorism, which has a whole ideology behind it. But that tension, right, between figuring out, is there another way? Right? The people who oppose it say, look, there's another way, and it's too dangerous to have a death penalty, and we always oppose death penalty. The people who say we want to have a death penalty, look, it hasn't worked. It's not deterring people, and we're letting them out in exchanges, so they're back out there. You're marbe shofchei damim.
That's way too simple. But maybe you stop some killing for a while by killing someone. Maybe you seek some Jews for it.
No, that's my point. The people who say you should have it, the people who say you should...
did in Gaza especially, maybe it saved people for a while.
So I want to sort of leave assassinations and the thing aside, because then you're getting into war, you know, war, which is a whole category in and of itself.
The death penalty instituted by the government.
So that's my assassinations might be more an act of war, and war is its own category, which is a sheer in and of itself, which I sort of actively had to not talk about. You're right that that's part of the question, right? Once you're talking about deterrence and avoiding and saving people's lives from potential murders, and you're dealing with preemptive strikes, and you're dealing with police action, with military action, which is a category in and of itself. But even just taking people who've been convicted, right? If you want to frame that debate in classic halachic language, you see how this is really the same tension that existed in halacha. Right, is exactly what it has now. Now, the way it currently stands, the only person who's put to death, you sort of understand why Israel is okay with the fact that the one person who's ever put to death, not everyone was okay with it, but most people are sort of okay with the fact that the one person put to death was Eichmann, was because it checked all the boxes. It was the person who, there was no question about it, and you felt that there was an educated, he deserved it. There was an, you know, it was educational for the world. It let people know that no matter what, you thought you were at the top of the world, you were, you know, higher, you know, upper echelons in the Nazi regime, you think that you could get away with it. There is an accounting in this world, right? That was unique. It was sui generis, right? It was what the death penalty was created for. So you understand why people are okay that was the one. You know, there were some people who didn't like that either. But why there was a general agreement that was okay was because it was unique in all the ways that we've talked about. So what I've just tried to do here is to sort of frame the debate and understand why there's so much tension in Israel, but not just to make it as if this is a new discussion. It's not. Those same values, those same tensions are the tensions that animate the classic halachic discussion, that have led to the balances that the Torah, that halacha has tried to have between, on the one hand, having it on the books, using it very sparingly, on the other hand, finding mechanisms when necessary to get rid of criminals or to contain them, right? That debate of how exactly we do it is exactly the sort of speaking to these same values. Now, as I said, I have given you sort of one here. There is this sort of modern tradition of poskim saying, you know what, with that, when there's no Sanhedrin, on balance, we should always err against the death penalty. And that's from Aaron Soloveitchik in his letter to David Lukens, and that's from Moshe Feinstein in his tshuva. And that also gets into a whole sort of more complicated discussion. You know, I'm going to have to end here. This is only in Israel, right? It gets more complicated, and you ask, what is our opinion outside of Israel? Because how do we relate to secular law? And secular societies, so that, you know, I've given you just a few sources on it, but we're not going to get to it. But I hope I've tried to at least frame the debate and understand the heavy value-laden opinions that there are on both sides, and say that both are, even if sometimes they're actually articulating halakhic sources, sometimes they're not, but even when they're not, how they are in a certain way reflecting the richness of Torah and rabbinic tradition on the topic, and how, you know, you understand why Israel is reticent to implement it, but even the people who are in favor of it, you understand the arguments they're giving emerge as well from Torah sources, whether they articulate it or not, and hopefully God will guide us to come to a decision that reflects his justice as best he would like as we go through the next few readings, because, as you said, the consequences are grave, whatever decision we make, but please, God, He will give us the strength and the wisdom to make the right decision.